The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Today, we're going to talk about the frontiers of physics. Particle physics, to be precise. As you listen to this podcast, protons are whizzing around accelerators buried deep beneath the Swiss and French Alps near Geneva. As they collide and break into their individual elements, they deepen our understanding of the fabric of matter. New particles, new forces could all be around the corner. At the Large Hadron Collider, the news is always big. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. On December the 13th, there'll be a public seminar at CERN, the particle physics lab that's the home of the Large Hadron Collider. Rumours in the blogosphere have suggested that this could be the date that scientists unveil their first glimpses of the Higgs boson, a fundamental particle that's required to complete the standard model of particle physics. Teams from the two detectors at CERN, called ATLAS and the Compact Muon Solenoid, or CMS, will present their results, compare them, and then stand back to work out the implications. Before heading out to CERN to prepare his presentation, Professor John Butterworth, leader of the UK team at ATLAS, head of the physics department at University College London, and also, by the way, a Guardian science blogger, joined me and the Guardian's Ian Sample to talk fundamental physics and how scientists do their work at the frontiers. We wanted to know whether the rumours were true, whether the discovery of the Higgs was really on its way into the newspapers. Was this the big moment that we've all been waiting for? I started by asking Ian to outline some of the rumours already doing the rounds.
Well, I think what's interesting is the email that went round from the Director General of CERN was kind of saying, look, essentially don't expect anything conclusive. But that they, both teams had come close, if not all the way, to analysing sort of all of their data collected up until the close of collisions, sort of proton-proton collisions in 2011. Now, whether, I mean, that sort of suggests that they aren't able to rule out the existence of a standard model Higgs boson, but they're probably not either also not able to confirm its existence. So you're looking at some sort of wishy-washy situation in between. Then it comes down to the interesting situation of what have they found and can you interpret anything from that? Does it shift the balance of probability of there being a standard model Higgs from one to the other?
John, you probably know what's going to happen on December the 13th. Can you tell us?
No, I'm not going to comment. I only know half of it anyway.
All right, okay.
My team are going to say.
But what is it that's Ian's sort of given us a bit of the background on what the announcement's going to be. But so as far as I understand, there's going the ATLAS experiment which you work on, and then the other experiment, the CMS, will both give a seminar on their latest analysis of data. So tell us what normally happens in these situations when you're announcing science from the LHC.
Well, I mean, the normal thing would be often we release results for conferences, which are not fully, they're not papers submitted for publication. They're kind of, there's usually some documentation to go with them. There's some plots. We discuss them in public. Then pretty soon a journal paper will follow after that. So in this case, I know ATLAS will be releasing some documentation to go with what we show on the Tuesday, which people will be able to see. Just slightly some more background, some more details than we'll be actually time for in the talk. And then pretty soon after that, a paper will follow. So that's the usual thing. And to be honest, I mean, this week is CERN. It's the CERN Council meeting. So it's the international funding bodies. Everyone are there. So there's always an update of the status of what happened this year there. So, and obviously the Higgs is the big news at the moment. So of course there'll be an update on whatever we can say about the Higgs. And just have to wait and see what we've got to say.
What are the things we already know about the possibilities? What are the ranges that have been narrowed down for the potential standard model Higgs so far?
Well, before we started, the Higgs could have had a mass anywhere between where the LEP experiment left off, which was the last one at CERN, which was 114 GeV, all the way up to a TeV or so, with a gap in the middle around 170 GeV where the Tevatron had excluded.
Just before we go on, it might be worth explaining what a GeV is, a giga electron volt.
So one electron volt is the energy of motion that an electron gets if you accelerate it through 1 volt. So if you have a 12-volt battery, then an electron accelerates through a 12-volt battery, it will have 12 electron volts of energy by the fact that it's moving after that. So a gigaelectron volt is, I always get my numbers wrong, but I think, is it 10 to the 9?
It's the mass of a proton, isn't it, roughly?
10 to the 9, so it's a billion.
It's about a mass of a proton.
It's about the mass of a proton if you multiply by c squared, yeah.
Okay, so then so you were saying about the potential mass of the Higgs.
Yeah, so, I mean, the whole reason the Higgs and the Higgs mechanism exist is to explain mass, and in order the mass of things like the W and the Z. And the reason, if it's going to do that, then it has to have a mass not too far from the W and the Z, and we ruled out certain places it could be. So we kind of knew that it was either within 114 up to, say, a few hundred GeV with a gap in the middle that Tevatron had already explored. And in the past year, we've basically closed off nearly all the high mass end of that.
The Higgs boson, for anyone who may not be familiar, is the quantum of the Higgs field. This is something that permeates the universe and gives the particles that we're all made of, the protons, the electrons, the neutrons, their mass. It also explains why, for example, the photon has no mass, and some very similar particles called the W and Z bosons do have mass. Photons carry the electromagnetic force around the universe at the speed of light. W and Z bosons carry something called the weak nuclear force, which only exists inside the nucleus of atoms and is partly responsible for things like radioactivity. At some point in the history of the universe, electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force were indistinguishable, the so-called electroweak force. But as the universe cooled, the Higgs boson started to flex its muscles. One of its effects was to snap the electroweak force into two. It coupled with the W and Z bosons, giving them mass and making them sluggish. But it left photons alone, free to roam at light speed. At least, that's the theory. To prove it correct, scientists at the LHC have to find the Higgs boson, and they hunt for it in the way they hunt for all the building blocks of our universe, by tearing bigger particles apart. The LHC zooms protons around its 27-kilometer accelerator, smashing them apart inside its detectors that are placed around the ring. The detectors, ATLAS and CMS, scan for the signatures of different fundamental particles in the debris. The Higgs boson has an individual signature predicted by theoretical physicists. What they don't know, however, is the particle's own mass. The mass of the Higgs boson has to be measured by experiment, and LHC scientists have been watching the spray of debris after each collision, carefully ruling out certain masses and narrowing down the possible range. A bit like scanning across the FM dial on a radio, they're looking for the signal for their very own radio station. So how close are the teams to finding Higgs boson FM?
We've covered getting on for 80% of that mass range that it could have been in. But the trick is that the place where most people would have said it would be, where all the indirect limits say it probably will be, is in the low end of that, near to 114. And that's really the hardest place to look. So the real thing to watch out for on Wednesday will be how far have we squeezed that range down? And as we squeeze it down, do we start to see anything popping up that might be a candidate? And as Ian said, it's not going to be definitive, but it will shift the balance of probabilities. And that's interesting. You know, this is how a discovery will eventually emerge, or else we'll rule it out and have to think of something better.
Does the fact that it's at the lower end of that energy scale make it simpler to find in terms of the fact that the LHC will get to those energies? Or you said it was more complicated.
It's
Why
harder.
Is that?
It's paradoxically. The reason for that is because the Higgs, the way that Higgs will show up depends critically on its mass. So we have plenty of energy to create it at the LHC over that whole range. But if it's above twice the mass of, say, the W boson, then it will decay to Ws. It always decays to whatever it can decay to, what the heaviest thing that it can possibly decay to.
Now, there are other possibilities, depending on how heavy the Higgs boson turns out to be. If it's not heavy enough to decay into two W particles, it might instead decay into two Z bosons. This would be very easy to spot, since the Zs would quickly decay into four leptons, a telltale signature at the LHC. If the Higgs is even less heavy than that, though, it gets really difficult to spot, because this means the boson would decay into the heaviest type of quark, the bottom or B quark.
As it gets lower, it can no longer decay to Ws and Zs, and what it decays to then dominantly is a B quark, and you get jets made of B quarks, get sprays of hadrons coming out. And the problem is the LHC's just got, it's full of sprays of hadrons. So it's almost an impossible signal to find. So it takes a lot, although we'd be making a lot more Higgses then if it's low mass, it's a lot harder to find them. It's a needle in a haystack that's a lot smaller, and the haystack's a lot bigger in that case than it would be if it was heavier.
John, if the LHC or Tevatron come out at some point and say they have found a particle, how do you know whether it's the Higgs or something else? I mean, how do you know that, you know, the Higgs has different properties to other particles? How do you know, just from the fact that it decays into this, that and the other at different masses, how do you know that that is actually then responsible for doing what the, you know, kind of what the Higgs field does, if you like? For
Well, the key element in that, well, first of all, it must have no charge and it must have spin zero and things, but those kind of things you can probably pin down at some point. But the key thing is what I was saying, it couples to mass. That's what it's for. It gives things mass. And the what we mean by coupling is it's the if you imagine it, you've made a Higgs and it's got an option to decay to a whole bunch of things. The coupling just tells it which, if the coupling's strong, it will decay to this. If it's weaker, it will decay to the other thing, something else less often. And it's measuring whether that coupling is what the standard model says it should be, which is basically going with the mass of the thing. And that's what I was saying, that you need to see this in several different channels
And with the frequencies you'd expect from the
exactly,
standard model.
Exactly, the proportionate rates and everything. Exactly.
So that kind of becomes the fingerprint for the particle.
That's right.
You decide it beforehand, that's how it should look. And if it looks like that, then almost by definition.
I mean, in a way, you know, it's in science, it's very, very hard to prove a positive, right? So you'd always have some questions. There are other things you can do. I mean, there are some processes at the LHC right at the very high energy tail that probably will be more common when we go to full energy in a couple of years. That actually, without the standard model Higgs, the answer is infinity, which is clearly nonsense. But that's where the Higgs really comes in and regularizes the standard model. So you'd also want to measure that in the end and check that it was really doing that, that you're really seeing the Higgs field, not just the Higgs boson then. So there's a lot of stuff you would do and to close up, to kind of build confidence this really was A, some kind of Higgs boson, and B, maybe the standard model Higgs boson. It's, in a way, it's a lot easier to prove a theory wrong than right, right? You never prove a theory wrong. A theory is always provisionally correct, and so you find another bit of data that says that things were travelling too fast or there's no Higgs or something.
Let's not talk about things travelling too fast. Okay. That's not what this is about. This is the neutrino-free zone. Oh, bollocks. Sorry about the language there. It's just that those pesky faster-than-light neutrinos that have come out of a separate experiment at CERN have been causing all sorts of problems recently, and we really do have enough to contend with right here. In particular, trying to understand the standard model of particle physics and how the Higgs boson fits into it. So let's just step back a bit, actually. This is probably the wrong way around slightly, but it might be worth quickly describing what the standard model Higgs field is meant to do and why it's so important to find something that does its job for the standard model, which is the sort of set of equations in particle physics that describe all the particles and the interactions between them. So give us your 1 minute on the Higgs
it's
field.
It's to do with symmetries. So it's to do with the fact that the theories, of quantum field theories that we have that describe these things, all rely on the presence of symmetries. And there's Tuft and Veltman won the Nobel Prize for proving that that's intimately tied to the fact that you can make any predictions with them at all. They're called gauge theories. The trouble is those symmetries actually, if you take them naively, forbid any particle from having any mass. Any mass breaks the symmetry. So what the Higgs mechanism does is, or the Higgs boson is the sign of the Higgs mechanism happening, is that it kind of allows the theory to have the symmetry overall, but in the low energy state that we live in every day, the symmetry is not there. So it's a thing we call spontaneously broken symmetry, and it's a mathematical trick in one way, but it's a very beautiful thing, and we do see cases that spontaneous broken symmetry does happen in things like ferromagnets. So it's a natural phenomenon that happens in other places. And the postulate here is that it actually is an intimate part of why the universe looks the way it is.
Symmetry, as you've heard there, is an important component of the modern quantum mechanical toolbox. It's required for the theories to work, but it also means that the particles we see, quarks, electrons and the rest, shouldn't have any mass. Clearly, though, they do have mass, and therefore the symmetry seems to be broken. You need the Higgs mechanism and the boson that goes with it to explain this conundrum, to give the particles mass and to allow the symmetry to remain blissfully unbroken. But before you go around thinking that the Higgs explains all mass, well, it doesn't. Ian, you wrote in a blog post, what's 2% of you, say?
Something like that, yeah.
Of course, then you've got dark matter. Which
Hold it there. Dark matter. Now, regular Science Weekly listeners will already be up to speed on this mysterious substance.
The most important property of dark matter is that it is not ordinary matter. So we've known for a long time that whatever it is not made of ordinary atoms.
In September, Professor Carlos Frank there of Durham University took Science Weekly on a tour of what he thinks dark matter might be. It's still online, so do go and have a listen. But for now, let's not get distracted by cosmological things. Back to the Higgs. But the Higgs mechanism, this thing we're all excited about, and the possible Higgs boson, if that does exist, explains about 2% of, let's say, baryonic matter, the mass of baryonic matter. And the rest is the binding energy between gluons, but that's another different conversation.
Well, I think it's true to say that if the quarks had absolutely zero mass, the proton wouldn't stick together. So indirectly, the whole thing relies on the Higgs, even that bit. But nevertheless.
And you've described a bit about during the collisions, you collide protons in the LHC, and these things smash apart, and there are all sorts of signatures of different particles that fly out of those things, mm-hmm. which you detect in ATLAS. And from the directions and the curls and all sorts of and the speeds of those things, you can detect mass, and you can tell what particle is what. And the Higgs boson, as you've said, would have a specific pattern. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you statistically know that you found a particular particle in the mechanism? We hear about something called the sigma. What is that?
It's a kind of indirect. It's a signifier of the probability of something just happening by random chance. So you could sit in one level, right, with the LHC, we're having these billions of collisions, and we're doing the same experiment over and over and over again, right? And in quantum mechanics, when you do the same thing, you don't get always the same result. You get, it's like rolling a dice. So we're rolling the same dice over and over again, if you like. And if you ask yourself, is this a fair dice? And you roll it, and you'd expect each number to come up a sixth of the time. But if you started noticing, say, six was coming up more often, you might think you got a signal for the dice being biased. So if you think of the Higgs as being a bias in the dice, and we have a distribution that should be completely flat if the dice was fair, but you see one face of the dice coming up a bit more often than you expect.
That means it's a signal.
Then there might be a signal there, but you have to ask yourself, what's the chances of that just being random, that it's a fair dice, but that's just a random fluctuation. So the sigma is to do with how often a random fluctuation will give you that false signal, that signal falsely. So we say three sigma, it's about 1% chance of you getting that. If the dice was fair, how often would you get that signal, right? And if it's three sigma, it's about 1%. We tend to go for five sigma as the kind of gold-plated, but it's all a bit arbitrary. It's really a level of probability. You know, it's a sliding scale. You build your confidence when you want. But the other complication in all that is that it's not just statistics, right? There are things called systematic errors in any experiment, and they're a lot harder to evaluate. So that's, for instance, how well do you actually systematically measure the energy of whatever it is you're seeing? If you're getting it wrong the same way every time, that's no longer a random error, and you have to try and account for those kind of errors as well. So then the whole language of sigmas becomes a little bit flaky, because you don't really know that everything's got this kind of beautiful statistical distribution.
So something might be a five sigma result by the statistics alone, but actually there's an error that you've not spotted in the equipment.
Precisely. And that every roll of your dice has the same error, so the more times you roll the dice doesn't help you, because you're making the same error every time. So that's a kind of systematic error. And we know about those things. We try and control them. You can control a lot of them from the data, from other bits of data, but still it's a very tricky game, and people tend to be rather conservative, especially with a relatively new experiment.
If you guys find something that explains why these fundamental particles have mass, whether it's the Higgs field or something else, does that automatically tell you why different particles weigh what they do?
No. It allows them to have mass, but it doesn't predict the masses. The exception is the W and the Z bosons. It's very intimately tied into that. So this thing called electroweak symmetry breaking, which is why the W and the Z have mass and the photon doesn't. That's very intimately tied to the Higgs with very few free parameters. But the masses of things like the electron and the quarks and that, no, they're it allows them to have it, but it doesn't actually predict what they are. So there's still, it will be a major advance in our understanding, but it's not like a theory of everything. It doesn't suddenly solve all our open questions.
So how do you go on to work that out? So presumably at some point you have to nail down, why is it that the top quark weighs so much and electron weighs not very much?
We'd like to know if there's... I mean, there are patterns like that. It's like, with the patterns you see in the periodic table. are kind of were due to the fact that the atoms are made of a number of protons and neutrons and electrons, and that was a hint of an underlying structure. It's very tempting to speculate that the pattern we see in fundamental particles is also a hint at some underlying order. Maybe they're made of something even smaller, or maybe there's some other symmetries in the theory that dictate what these things would be. Because there's no guarantee that that's the case, right? I mean, we shouldn't get too carried away with our reductionism of nature and trying to make everything in one equation. On the other hand, this has been a very fruitful line of reasoning and inquiry to pursue, and we've just got to be a little humble about it and not expect that there will be an ultimate answer. But on the other hand, looking for the ultimate answer is an extremely entertaining and productive thing to do.
John, you hinted there about the ultimate answer. I mean, if you narrow down the range for the Higgs boson, if it exists, and you carry on doing that, and then you find actually that perhaps there isn't one, or that you can't find it, at what point do you start entertaining other possibilities? I mean, people are already discussing this, and the Nobel Prize winner, mm-hmm. Steven Weinberg, has even said publicly that if you do find the Higgs, it'd be quite boring, actually, that you really, really don't want to find it.
Well, I've sat through so many talks where the conclusion of some beautiful measurement is, and this is all consistent with the standard model. The tragedy is, if we find the Higgs boson, then that will be the punchline of that one too. And it would be nice to have a punchline that said, okay, this isn't, the standard model's wrong, actually. Part of me sympathises strongly with that. And on the other hand, it's much nicer to find something than nothing.
Now, no matter what scientists at CERN announce next, it probably isn't going to be a gateway to another dimension. It didn't stop Ian Sample from asking, though. And as you'll see, it's not quite as random a question as you might think.
John, doesn't the extra dimensions idea feed into this whole idea of LHC producing black holes in some level?
Yeah, the way that we might have, and I guess still might be, produced black holes is that there are extra dimensions, and in some models, gravity knows about all the extra dimensions, but the other forces don't. What happens is, you get to a certain energy scale where you can suddenly start to see the extra dimensions, then gravity gets as strong as the other forces because they're all going through these extra dimensions then. And it's at that stage then that you can you have enough energy then to create black holes. If there's no extra dimensions, there just isn't enough energy at the LHC to do it. But if you had that kind of scenario where gravity becomes strong, and this is what I was saying, the Planck scale is effectively then the same as the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, and then you can make black holes, but they also decay very, very quickly by the same mechanism. But we've been looking for them and we haven't seen any yet, so it's becoming a little less plausible.
You tend to think of black holes as things that would be quite easy to spot, like sort of like right at the middle of a galaxy with loads of stuff falling into it, and the sort of black holes that you know theoretically are on, you know, might be on the cards of the LHC, we're talking about something very different.
They're very, very tiny, and in these models, well, what we know is that if it's possible to create black holes by those energies, they certainly don't grow and suck stuff in, because they would be being created all over the place. In natural phenomena as well, right? But what would happen if these theories are correct is that they're created and they decay almost instantaneously, but they don't really look like any other particle that we're familiar with. So the signature is a whole bunch of mess, yeah. Which is, you know, we've made a lot of mess, but none of it looks like a black hole yet.
Just to wind up, I suppose, John, it'd be really worth talking about some of these other sort of at the extreme theoretical ideas like supersymmetry, technicolor, these sorts of ideas that actually there are lots of other things that the LHC could find evidence of in the next few years. So let's talk a bit about the future beyond this boson question. What other things are you going to be looking for? Supersymmetry, for example, tell us what that is and how you're going to find it if it's there.
Right, so well, supersymmetry is I mentioned earlier that our theories of nature are intimately tied together with supersymmetry, with symmetries in general, sorry. Supersymmetry is kind of the last missing symmetry. It's mathematically speaking very special in that it's the only one left that nature hasn't used, so it seems plausible to suspect it might use it somewhere. String theorists tell you supersymmetry is essential, but they don't tell you it has to be LHC energies, it could just be anywhere. But what it does is it introduces a symmetry between actually the force-carrying particles and the particles themselves. So it's all the electron and the quark and things, and the neutrinos, they all have spin half, they're all fermions. And all the forces, all the particles that carry forces between them, like the photon that carries electromagnetism or the gluon that carries a strong force, as we mentioned earlier, they're all bosons. They all have spin one, and their Higgs is the only thing with spin zero.
Why is that not got a spin one then if it's a boson? Is that a terrible question to ask?
No, not at all. No, boson, it's the key thing is whether it's an integer or a half integer. So anything with a half integer spin is a fermion, and anything with an integer spin being zero, one, or two.
Silly question out of the way. Off you go.
Gravitons would be bosons too, and they would have spin two if they exist. This supersymmetry introduces a symmetry between the force carriers. It's finally the completion of the symmetry cycle, you know, between the force carriers and the things they carry the forces between. So there'd be a neutrino, which is a neutrino but with spin one, for instance. And there'd be a photino, which is a photon but with spin half.
So the photon, which is a boson, would have a fermion partner,
exactly,
which is the photino, which is something that you might be able to find if supersymmetry exists.
That's right.
And so you're doubling the number of particles out there, essentially.
And increasing the parameters in the standard model and stuff a lot. But it does have some neat... I mean, one of the really puzzling things is, right, and this is, to me, this is why the LHC is as exciting as it is, really, right, is that we know that there's a unification of forces at the electroweak scale, which is the mass, roughly the mass of the Higgs, or if it's there, or the W or the Z. There's this kind of scale in nature, this mass scale in nature, and it's got units, you know. Why does nature pick this scale? Naturally speaking, there's no scales between zero and the Planck mass, right? And, well, the only other one we know is actually the proton mass, a strong force generates a scale, but anyway, we know
the
that
Planck mass is the smallest super possible high,
10 to the 19 some
highest
number
possible.
It's where quantum gravity and everything has to come in. It's the true event horizon of our knowledge at some level, but it's a long way away from where we can study experimentally at the moment. But we know that within reach of the LHC there is this unification scale where the strong electromagnetic force and the weak force actually come together, and that's not speculation. We've measured that we've seen that these forces do come together at that point. And that's where the mass of the particles is generated. And above that, these particles are effectively massless. So that's why this is where the Higgs has to be, if it's there, because it's intimately tied in with that symmetry breaking. And so I think, to me, we're looking at physics in a qualitatively new regime. And I really just want to look at it. And it's, all bets are kind of off up there, right? We've got our theoretical armory to take us to the electroweak symmetry breaking scale. And it's the Higgs, as everyone was saying, that it's very hard to find a plausible alternative for it, but there are some candidates.
Other ideas, yeah.
But there's no reason to think physics looks just like that above this scale. It's really an event horizon. It's really a special energy scale that we're looking above for the first time.
And is it even possible to get up there for those sorts of energy scales in the collisions?
Yeah, for sure. No, that's why we built the thing. That's why we went to all this effort. 27 kilometers of superconducting magnets get you there. But it takes a while to accumulate the statistics to really scope the whole thing out. And of course, we've been looking like crazy for things like supersymmetry and black holes.
What would be the evidence of it? I was going to say, how would you know you've found a supersymmetric particle?
In a lot of trouble with SUSY is supersymmetry is that it's got a lot of variance. It has a lot of free parameters, but a very generic property of a lot of these variants is that the supersymmetric particles have to be created in pairs, and then once you've created them, they carry with them a quantum number, so they can't decay. The lightest one can't decay to anything, and what that is, that's one of the reasons supersymmetry, another reason supersymmetry is attractive, and that could be dark matter. That could be that lightest supersymmetric particle could be the dark matter in the universe that we have evidence for from galaxy rotation curves and things as well. But we don't know what it is. Well, that's a very natural candidate coming from particle physics. But the way we see those in our detectors is actually we don't see them. so they don't interact at all. So you end up with an imbalance in your detector, missing energy or something, and you can... Missing energy happens when neutrinos are created in the detector as well, and that does happen, but we can predict how often that happens. And if we see it happening more often than we expect or in particularly unusual events, that could be a very convincing signal for supersymmetry. As I say, of course, we've been looking for all these things as well as looking for the Higgs boson. So far, we haven't seen anything. But.
And what stage will you start to get to the top energies for the LHC? You've not been colliding at full energy yet.
No, that's right.
So what's the sort of plan for that?
So we will run through this year. We may get we hope we'll get a small increase in energy next year.
2012.
In 2012. And then we'll run all the way through 2012, get a lot of data, we hope. This is the plan. And then we'll shut down probably for something like 18 months, and that's when the whole machine will be upgraded so that it can go. The kind of you remember in 2008 there was an accident and it failed when it tried to go up to high energy, and it's known why that happened now, but there's some work needs to be done to prepare it to do that. So there'll be a long shot down. We'll also upgrade some of the detectors, make them able to cope with more data, and then hopefully come back in kind of early 2014 at something close to twice the energy we have now.
So that will be the maximum capacity, so 14 tera-electron volts at that point in 2014-15.
Yeah.
And then you have a couple more years of data collecting, anything comes out of that.
With going up in energy, you saw this time, you get some results out very quickly, but then to scope out the full energy range takes a while. You have to look at the data. It's like you get a very quick look at a whole bunch of new terrain, and if there's anything obvious there, it will come up pretty quickly. But usually there isn't, and you have to go and do a more careful job analysing the data.
What is what's the mood like at CERN at the moment? I mean, everyone's sort of watching you, or pretty much with whatever announcement you make, and speculating and doing podcasts and blogs and things about things, and trying to get you to reveal the existence of a boson that may or may not exist, and maybe isn't that important in the whole scheme of things. Is it an exciting place to be, or are you just a bit annoyed by the overawing attention?
It's completely frenetic. There are a lot of people not getting enough sleep, and that's just par for the course in science at a key bit of an experiment. That's true whether you're looking for the Higgs boson or you're trying to get your protein crystallography done on your beamline in diamond or something. People just don't sleep enough and sometimes don't wash enough as well. The way people react to the great public interest and media interest in this is interesting. It depends a lot on their personalities. There are some scientists who really just think this is a disaster. We should have kept it all quiet and revealed the result 10 years down the line. And all the politicians are going to hate us because they won't understand the result, or we won't find it and they'll think it's a failure. And there's a lot of paranoia about that with some people. Other people, of which I would say I'm one, is think that it's a golden opportunity to explain to people kind of how science is done. And what scientists mean when they talk about a balance of probabilities and experimental error and you know, wait and see until we publish it because this is only a rumor, and it turned out yes, it was only a rumor, and those kind of things, it's good. And also not just even how science works in the purest sense, but the fact that there are a lot of people with huge egos and axes to grind and things who will tell you different stories, and that's the way it is. But nevertheless, an objective discovery or not of the Higgs will emerge from this chaos, and this shows you how science is, even under all this pressure, science is just the best way we have of not fooling ourselves. And there's plenty of people at CERN who are fooling themselves, but in the end the data will tell us the answer, and though we may deny it for a while, in the end people will have to face up to whatever it is the data tells us.
And there you have it. With experimental particle physics, it's always down to the data. Let's see what the data says on December the 13th. Whether it's the discovery of the Higgs boson, the particle we've all been waiting for, or whether it's something so strange that we have to develop an entirely new bit of physics to explain it, we'll bring you the latest on guardian.co.uk/science. This special edition of Science Weekly owes an enormous debt to the patience and storytelling expertise of Professor John Butterworth. You can read all of John's blog posts on the science going on at the Large Hadron Collider at his blog, hosted by The Guardian, at guardian.co.uk/science. Just click on the link for Life and Physics. Thanks also to The Guardian science correspondent, Ian Sample. Ian's book on all this stuff, The Search for the Higgs, is called Massive, the missing particle that sparked the greatest hunt in science. It's available at all good retailers and fits perfectly into an oversized Christmas sock. I'm Alok Jha, and Science Weekly was produced by Jason Phipps, with a soundtrack by Music by Association. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Whoa!
Look at that! Did you see that?
Entropy.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.